Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of the Damage Report Lockdown Edition. On Wednesday, which is important for reasons I'll get into in about 15 seconds, hopefully everything's going to work. Obviously, if you were tuning in live yesterday, we did have some technical issues. We're hoping they're all resolved. Earlier today, my guest and I had some Skype issues, so screw Skype, we're not using it right now. We've got an awesome show planned for you. I'll give you details in just a second. Thank you to everybody who has already joined in the chat. The thing I'm most excited about today is that it is not just Wednesday, it is JR Wednesday, and JR Jackson joins us now. How's it going, JR?
What's going on, John? You know what? No technical difficulties from JR Wednesday's side, man. We're going to make this happen. You know why we have the power of the quarantine beard going?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I actually brushed mine too. Mine is starting to grow a little bit too. Yours is longer.
This is getting out of control, bro.
Yeah. I was just looking at some photos of when I was in the Arctic, and you're past that level, the maximum. Not overall, but the maximum length is like twice as long.
I usually keep something here, and now if I let everything go, we're going to have a problem.
Yeah. So to give you an idea of what we're going to be talking about today, we do have some fallout from yesterday's Trump press conference. I want to criticize Trump, obviously, but the media as well, because, man, though, the bar is always sinking when it comes to him, and it looks like, indeed, they can hear everything. Awesome. Yeah, we are totally color coordinating today, by the way.
Oh.
the all blue. We're feeling blue because we're stuck at home. Updated potential death counts from the administration. We'll be talking about that. Updates also on the Senate insider trading issue that I don't think is being talked about nearly enough. And then we've got other stuff too, how the coronavirus is affecting the environment and the EPA. And The View is having Bernie Sanders on. This is going to be the last story, so stick around for the full show. You have to see a promo that they ran about Bernie Sanders' impending appearance. Like, if it had been on Fox News, I would have thought, that's about what I would expect. But this is The View. Take a look in a little bit at what they had to say about him. Yesterday, Donald Trump finally seemed to accept that this is not going to be sort of an easy road that we're going down, and that, in fact, many Americans might end up losing their lives. Here is what he had to say.
We're going to go through a very tough 2 weeks. And then hopefully, as the experts are predicting, as I think a lot of us are predicting after having studied it so hard, you're going to start seeing some real light at the end of the tunnel. But this is going to be a very painful, very, very painful 2 weeks. When you look and see at night the kind of death that's been caused by this invisible enemy, it's incredible. I was watching last night Governor Murphy of New Jersey say 29 people died today, meaning yesterday. And
okay, so JR, there you had him admitting that we're going to have a very difficult 2 weeks, a very, very painful 2 weeks. And he admitted hearing that in one area, 29 people had died just overnight. And so he's accepting it's going to be very bad. That's good. I kind of wish that he had been talking about this 2 months ago, that if he had, perhaps Fox News would have felt freed up to admit that it's going to be bad. Not just because, you know, people should understand what's going to happen, but because governors and mayors could have put social distancing policies into effect earlier. We know that some places like DeSantis in Florida, still, he seems to think, well, you know, we've closed down some beaches, but do we really have to go crazy over this thing? Perhaps if Donald Trump had reached the point he did on April 1st, and because of that date, I'm a little bit worried that this is all some sort of April Fool's joke. Maybe we would be better equipped nationally to deal with this.
Yeah, so if with anything else, with a job of any other nature or significance or importance, if your track record tells us that you don't take things seriously until it's gotten to a point where it only affects you, I don't take you seriously until I know for sure that it affects you. But even then, what happens is you'll protect yourself and not the people that are affected directly.
Yeah.
So it's I don't know, man. There's going to be no way that I'm going to take anything he says as any kind of a positive warning going forward.
Yeah. Yeah. And especially as we're going to get into how directly contradictory what he's saying now is to what he had said before, the perception he wants you to have. And so let's play one other video. This is going to be Acosta, who asks him about the seeming turn in the way he's talking about this. And here is what Trump had to say.
I think it's very important.
It wasn't going to be this severe when you were saying this was under control.
I thought it could be. I knew everything. I knew it could be horrible, and I knew it could be maybe good. Don't forget, at that time, people didn't know that much about it. Even the experts, we were talking about it. We didn't know where it was going. We saw China, but that was it. Maybe it would have stopped at China. We wish we could have killed it in China. But it didn't happen. It started spreading to Europe. It started spreading here. It started spreading all over. But, and I'm not blaming anybody. I'm just saying that we have an incredible thing.
So, I love that video because he says, I knew everything. I knew it could be bad. I knew it could be maybe good. And look, I know that he has the worst vocabulary of anybody who regularly has a camera shoved in their face. But what the hell are we supposed to think you mean when you said you were looking at the situation in China and you thought maybe it could be, end up being good? And also, well, let's say hypothetically it could be good in that maybe it wouldn't spread all over the world, even though people were definitely worried about that at that point. You don't just watch it week after week after week. You do something. You know, we could have used the CDC being spurred to start spreading, producing and distributing tests all around the country. Wouldn't it have been nice to have a 6 or 8 or 10 week advantage on that? We could have had that, but you apparently knew everything and did nothing. And so
it's either a lie that he knew everything, which of course he has the opportunity and the means to know everything and do nothing. Or, I mean, we did get Wilbur Ross. Let's not forget, Wilbur Ross did get in front of cameras. And when this was all starting, when we thought it was only something that was going on in this particular section of the world over in China. So he said this could actually be good for the economy because he was thinking it's going to put their economy in decline, their production in decline, and then those things would actually come to affect us positively. That's where he was like, oh, I was thinking maybe it'd be good for us because we, again, thought this is so foreign and it goes to these enemies of ours, these economic enemies of ours. So therefore, we'll let them take care of it, and they're going to be hurt, and we're going to reap the benefits of this. Mm-hmm. Again, not preparing for the possibility of things coming this direction, which his only preparation for that actually was travel bans, which he was trying to put in place. And he's bragged about how that he was in the forefront of travel bans. Again, let's go back to your track record. No one trusts your track record on travel bans because you flippantly put those in positions before out of racial animosity towards a particular group. We know how you operate, so no one wants to hear about your travel bans when you're talking about blocking another country from having any travel here.
Yeah, and also, that, like, if that was what you believed was the only thing that needed to be done, and that's what you did, let's say hypothetically everything he says about his view of travel bans was true. Right now, as of my reload, there are 205,000 cases in the United States alone. Already almost 500 new deaths reported today. Does it seem like the travel ban worked? Maybe restricting travel would be a good idea, but also prepare for the inevitable likelihood that it would not keep the disease out. And if people, even if one or if two or if 10 people get over, then it could spread. So maybe we should be ready for it. But he still wants credit for something that has obviously not succeeded. Imagine at this late date still thinking that you deserve credit for something that clearly didn't stop more than a fifth of a million people getting the disease as of today, let alone in a week or two.
Yeah, and really fast. Sorry, go ahead.
I want your reaction to this too, because this is something that we've been talking about for a while, but this was a slide from the press conference yesterday. And look at the look on his face as he gazes at how many people might die if nothing is done, and how many people might die. The goals of community mitigation. So the goal is 100 to 200,000 deaths. And he looks at it like I might look at the menu of a restaurant when I'm not particularly hungry. Like, really, do I have to deal with this? Honestly, do I have to? And understand, like, he could put pressure on states across the country for a national social distancing stay-at-home order. He can't necessarily force it, but if he wants to pressure states, he's not shy about doing that under normal circumstances. If he really wanted, if that was really a goal, he could be pursuing it far stronger than he is now.
Yeah.
And that's the goal.
So give me this screenshot. Okay. Yes. He's looking at this curve, right?
Yep.
The main thing is he doesn't understand it. And maybe they tried to brief him on it beforehand. Maybe they tried to give him some clues about what he's going to be looking at as he gets to this point. But it's a confused child in a classroom setting that's been called in front of the class to explain his the lesson of the day. And he's unable to do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, straight up, I know there's a lot of childlike connections and comparisons we make of him, but they're too obvious for us not to.
Yeah.
It's a daily illustration in how woefully unprepared and honestly unwilling to learn that this guy has. And we've, again, this is not new. It's not new. We've heard about it from the beginning. And this was people that had Trump derangement syndrome and people that were just hate the president just because of who he is and all that stuff that refuse to believe. He's shown us from the beginning. He's uninterested in learning things. He's uninterested in reading. He's uninterested in briefings that are longer than a page with a bunch of pictures. Yeah. All this was said beforehand. This shouldn't be surprising to anyone, but we weren't paying attention because we said, yeah, it'll be okay. It's Donald Trump, right?
Yeah, you know, what's the worst case scenario? I mean, nothing bad ever happens in the world. Nothing that actually requires leadership or understanding or respect for expertise or anything like that. It's just the world.
Yeah, which goes to my other point. There was pandemic preparedness sheets put together back in September of last year, specifically within his administration, put together for the potential for something like this to happen, how it can affect the economy, lives, and worldwide on a pandemic. They didn't. They called it something like a flu-like pandemic, but didn't, of course, call it particularly this. And their gauges were based off something that isn't as deadly or as contagious as this is.
Yeah.
There was guidelines put in place to approach something like that. They were ignored as well, an Obama administration era worksheet or a guideline put together after they went through everything with I want to say swine, but it wasn't swine flu, it was Ebola.
Yeah,
so that was put together after they went through that and whatever mistakes or whatever accomplishments they did put together as a guideline, ignored, put aside, collected dust on the shelf.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, "You must unlearn what you have learned." And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Donald Trump admitted at yesterday's press conference that 100,000 to 200,000Americans could die, even if the goal is reached, even if all of the advice that they're providing, advice and little else, is actually followed, that could happen. And because he admitted that, media figures, pundits, and writers have just tripped over themselves to give him credit once again for the moment when he became presidential. And so just as a few examples, and I'm not really trying to single out anyone, but we do need to show you some examples of this. So Eric Lipton said, "Trump sounding different today. Scale of death appears to have changed his tone at least." He did put "at least," so that's good. Jake Sherman, "This is absolutely new message and new tone from Trump." Acosta, who's in that video we showed you earlier, "This was a different Donald Trump tonight. I think he gets it." Look, I get that I have Trump derangement syndrome. I don't think he gets it. Kelly O'Donnell says the tone and seriousness was different today. Okay, so he talked about, you know, the fact that so many people might die. But like, honestly, how after 3+ years of this could you think that what he said yesterday has any correlation to what he'll say tomorrow, to what insane theory he'll come up with, what weird CEO he'll trot in front of the cameras, what reporter he'll like misogynistically attack? Like, the idea that he has changed, he can't change in any significant way. And even if he could, he would refuse to because he thinks that he is perfect in literally every way. I don't understand how the media can still be fooled by this, by a speech, by an appearance with a teleprompter, by any of that, that they could still think that it means anything.
I don't know. This is why he's gotten through life the way he has. He's had a lifelong, an adult life full of failures, brought on by himself, instituted by himself. But every time he's done so, he's gotten an excuse, or when he's come up with an excuse, people have accepted it. So when you accept someone's excuses for their incompetence, they'll continue to engage in that same behavior. And we see it over and over again. So it's been 3 years of sheer incompetence and failure. He changes his tone for one press conference and he's getting praise for it. This is the approach we've taken. It's been a couple times, by the way. He launches bombs into the Middle East and we go, look at those beautiful bombs. Brian Williams, established NBC News anchor. Look at those beautiful bombs. It's like the 4th of July. So doing those things, it encourages him to continue this behavior. So you think he's not reading everyone's tweets saying, oh, look, Trump's tone has changed. Looks like he gets it. He's like, yep, that's right. I got it. And as soon as he goes to that pompous point of view, he reverts right back to where he was before because that's who he is.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, look, if he was to read the reaction and actually change, okay, that's sort of putting social pressure. I have no problem with that. It's just that I don't trust literally any of this. And I don't get how these people who are, you know, they're obviously far smarter than us and far better educated, far better trained, have more experience, these lofty, dignified reporters and pundits and hosts, that they could still be falling into this trap. Like people who have themselves been viciously attacked and mocked and lied about by this president. This president who is clearly trying to do a little bit of PR, like some of the hosts on Fox are, about the way he's talked about this disease before, and we'll have more on that in just a minute. I shouldn't be surprised. But these are the people that they continually say are the fake news, that they have Trump derangement syndrome, they're just trying to take down the president, and they are doing everything they can to extend an olive branch to a guy who is going to, like, just snatched out of their hand and began beating them with it.
So I'm sorry. So there was one small thing on that point, because we were talking about how the media figures are saying his tone has changed and they're being nice to him. I have not a hypothesis, but it's part of the thought process that people have. So it's based off of what we always say. If you be nice, things can change with this president. So why does that have to be a requirement is my question. Hey, who cares if we're nice to him? If I'm the president of the United States and say 70% of the population hates me and says all these things about me, doesn't like my face, doesn't like the color tie I wear, doesn't like my shoes, whatever it is that he says are outward disconnected reasons to dislike him. That's his stance. That's his point of view. They just hate me to hate me, which is BS. Fine, whatever. Even if you hate me just to hate me, it's still my job to protect the American people. It's still my job to take these press briefings seriously. It's still my job to take any intelligence briefings. It's my job to stop this pandemic. I don't care how much you dislike me or like me. Why is that a requirement based off whether or not you do your job? It shouldn't be, and it's not. But in this guy's case, it is. So be nice to me, and maybe I'll do my job. Hey, that sounds like you shouldn't be doing this job.
Yeah. 100%. You wouldn't accept it anywhere else. Why would you accept it from the most powerful person in the country? Yesterday, when the media was giving Trump credit for changing his tone and seeming more serious, more recognizing of the threat faced by coronavirus, the damage that's going to be done, it was frustrating to me because I know what he's said before and what he's done so far. And what do you know? It didn't take even a day. In that same press conference, he started to try to rewrite what he's said before. So we're going to play two videos, and then we're going to correct the record with a bit of fact-checking. So here's the first.
I've known this for a long time. The question is, what would have happened if we did nothing? Because there was a group that said, let's just write it out. Let's write it out. What would have happened? And that number comes in at 1.5 to 1.6 million people, up to 2.2 and even beyond. So that's 2.2 million people would have died if we did nothing. We just carried on our life. Now, I don't think that would have been possible because you would have had people dying all over the place. This would not have been a normal life. How many?
So there he says, you know, what if we had done nothing? What if we had just tried to ride this out? What if we had pretended like everything was going to be okay? So here's the thing. I can think of a few people who tried to imply that we could just ride this out. Do you remember like 3.5 days ago when he was saying by Easter, we're going to be cool? You know, when he was on Fox News with Sean Hannity and he was saying, you know, a lot of people, like their symptoms aren't going to be bad and they're going to go to work and it's going to be okay. And then suddenly they're just going to get better. So we have another video that's going to be worse. But from the beginning, the idea that other people were saying, don't do anything, just ride this out, JR. What do you think about him taking that tone now?
Well, because others said that. So he's of course, detaching himself from himself who said these things. And honestly, you know what? I just read something this morning. Devin Nunes is upset that California, of course, he's representative of California, that California schools are pretty much considering to cancel the rest of the school year and then do whatever they're doing remotely. And he said, you know, it's way overblown, all this stuff. We should be back in 2 to 4 weeks. They're still pushing this line. So, hey, detach yourselves from people like him, one of your best friends and biggest supporters through all of the craziness that you've put the country through. Detach yourselves from them as well. It's rewriting history. This is the most important part of this pandemic to him, is making sure that he comes out scot-free and clean from it rather than having any kind of responsibility to it or connection to it or effect on it spreading even further.
Yeah,
that's the idea.
But here he gets more specific. He wants you to be angry at the people who tried to pretend for literally weeks that this was just the flu.
A relatively short period of time. But think of what would have happened if we didn't do anything. I mean, I've had many friends, business people, people with great actually common sense. They said, why don't we write it out? A lot of people have said, a lot of people have thought about it. Write it out. Don't do anything. Just write it out and think of it as the flu. But it's not the flu. It's vicious. When you send a friend to the hospital and you call up to find out how is he doing, it happened to me where he goes to the hospital, he says goodbye, he's sort of a tough guy, a little older, a little heavier than he'd like to be, frankly. And you call up the next day, how's he doing? And he's in a coma? This is not the flu.
Okay, so JR, there he says, you know, people are like, this is just the flu. It's not the flu. It's vicious. He tells a story about his friend who's a little bit older, a tough guy who's a little bit heavier than he wants to be, who suddenly is in a coma. I'm fairly certain he is making that up and he's talking about himself and his fears about himself getting coronavirus, because that sounds made up. We can't say for sure, but you never know with him because he's a massive liar. But there he said people were trying to act like this was just the flu, and that's irresponsible because this is not just the flu.
Oh, well, again, so we have to make sure that, I don't know if he knows if he's having this argument with himself, and also the fact that things that he said and tweeted in the past are still there. They exist. Again, I don't. What's the end game? I'm still not sure how he expects this to go over well. Mm-hmm. No one believes it. His supporters don't believe it. Because the reason why I know his supporters don't believe it is because his supporters believed him when he said the opposite.
Yeah.
And did the opposite. And how we need to be back and the economies to come back. And what was it? You said it was even last week. We can't let the remedy be worse than the
yeah. Itself, or we can't let the cure be worse than the disease.
What does that mean?
That means go back to normal. That's what it means.
It's like last week, but it doesn't matter. He just says it and walks away. And then if a reporter asks him, say, so you said this last week, 2 weeks ago, last month, 2 months ago. And you know what he says to them instead? You're a nasty reporter. That's a nasty question.
Yeah.
This is a doozy. Hey, why don't you guys ask questions that actually help people? All these things, instead of answering a question and point out his the history he's got behind it. Again, that's the theme here. Every time he's gotten upset at a reporter in these briefings, it's because they asked him about his previous response. That is the key. That's the thing that hooks him, because that's what he doesn't want to have happening. It's him being connected to what he did.
Harum says, worse than a pathological liar, disingenuous. And so, you know what? I would like to be very briefly, if you'll bear with me, I would like to be a bad reporter. I would like to be nasty and threatening and not nice. Because when he says other people were pretending that it was just the flu, I thought, Well, that's weird, because I'm pretty sure over the last month I've read many articles with him saying that it was just the flu. In fact, we've talked about it before on the show, so I did a little bit of digging online. And here's a few things. March 9th. So last year, 37,000 Americans died from the common flu. It averages between 27 and 70K per year. Nothing is shut down. Life and the economy go on. At this moment, there are 546 confirmed cases of coronavirus with 22 deaths. Think about that. So he's saying there's like none, and we don't shut it down even if it was way worse. So he is definitely saying just ride it out, don't do anything. And he is comparing it to the common flu, but hold for just a sec, because it gets worse. Okay, just a week ago, Trump told Fox News in an interview that despite deaths of about 36,000 people a year on average from flu, quote, we've never closed down the country for the flu. So you say to yourself, what is this all about? So 1 week ago on Fox News, he's saying, we don't close things down. But it's even worse, because we had a press conference, this is back, I believe, on February 26th. And there's a few quotes there that are just amazing. He said, at that point, we've had some pretty bad flus, and we've had some pretty bad viruses, and we've never closed the country before. We have to go back to work. So again, we've had disease before, we've had flus before, what are we going to shut things down? He said this at that same one, February 26th. When I mentioned the flu, I said, actually, I asked the various doctors, I said, is this just like flu? Because people die from the flu. And this is very unusual, and it is a little bit different, but in some ways it's easier, and in some ways it's a little bit tougher. Yeah. And then when he says people say it's just like the flu, at that February 26th press conference, I found a quote that seems to indicate a little bit of hypocrisy when he said, this is a flu. This is like a flu.
I'm trying to figure out how you read so deep into that to get that he said this is a flu, John. Come on.
This is a flu. This is like a flu. Who are these people saying it's like a flu? This is a flu. This is like a flu. Those people were irresponsible. People will die because they didn't take it seriously. This is a flu. This is like a flu.
Blood on their hands.
Now, it doesn't matter, like, in terms of the reporters. They can't, like, if Yamiche takes this quote and reads it to him, it's not going to get him, because you can't get him. His fans don't care. And you know, as I was getting some of these quotes, some were tweets. And so when you go back to a tweet from 3 weeks ago, the responses generally are from that day. And so some of his tweets where he was saying the media is like freaking out, they're trying to create a panic, they're pretending this is going to be really bad, there were responses with thousands of retweets of, you know, Trump super repliers who were like, yeah, the media is just trying to crash the economy, this isn't a big deal. And like, I looked at those names and I thought, do any of those people now think, wow, I was really misled? The media was right. This is really bad. There aren't 500 cases anymore. There are 200,000 cases right now and getting worse.
Yeah, once Trump takes his, quote, serious tone that everyone's giving him credit for now, do they think, oh, the serious tone, now it's a big deal. Now it's for real. But, you know, a month ago, it wasn't for real. 2 weeks ago, it wasn't for real. Last week, it wasn't for real. Because that's how recently.
Yeah.
He's been pushing this narrative. I don't know. It's would be a great question to ask, because there's probably been countless mental collisions of reality from his supporters have had to have had every time they believed something he said and then saw the reality way later and had to deal with the fact that they were told the opposite and believed it. And it's tough, I guess, man. That's your hero. So, you know, you go for it. But then eventually you have to realize your hero is not working for you.
A massive liar.
Yeah.
And I just want to add one more thing. This is a flu. This is like a flu. It's literally what he was attacking. It couldn't be more direct.
Can I give you an example of a real denial that turned into a real apology and real acknowledgement? So yeah. Evangeline Lilly, who was on, who's like Ant-Man, what's it, Wasp, the Wasp, right?
Yeah, Ant-Man and the Wasp.
And she was in Lost, if you want to go way back. So she came out originally.
The Hobbit.
And she was dropping, The Hobbit. I didn't see it. I heard that was going to be good. She came out originally talking about how frustrated she is at the panic and the anxiety and the pushing things aside. And she dropped her kids off at gymnastics and posted, they washed their hands, they're fine, moving on with life, right? And then she got some pushback, and then reality continued to set in, and she saw what was really going on. So her motivations were based on whatever. She came forward with an apology. And this is how you apologize. She goes, weeks ago. First of all, I apologize for people that I dismissed, the people that are most affected, and all this for my flippant approach, right? I'm paraphrasing. She may not necessarily use those words. And then went on to say, I was masking my own fears and concerns about it by trying to go on with a normal everyday life and not acknowledging it. Yeah. That's a real apology that actually talks about the people you hurt, talks about the reasons why you did the stuff that you did, and then acknowledges that you've switched it and the reasons why you have. That's how you acknowledge that you were wrong before and now you've come to this point because you actually care, yeah, rather than someone who doesn't care and all they're looking for is to protect their ego and their image. That's the difference. She's a celebrity. She's a known figure. She's someone who probably benefits from people knowing who she is and having a positive outlook about her. But sometimes it helps to just point out that you were wrong. You were the stupid one. You were the one that was causing the problem and move on. And people might actually like you for it.
Yeah. Yeah. Like imagine if Sean Hannity did that. Imagine if he was like, you know what? You know, I've got a lot of reasons to distrust the media and the way that they attack Trump, but I allowed that bias to lead me to believe that they were wrong on something that they were 100% not wrong on. And to the extent that I misled people about this, I apologize. You should take it totally seriously. Listen to the doctors. Like, we would be, he would be twisting our arm to give him credit, but he's not going to do it.
All you gotta do is change your tone and you'll get enough acceptance.
Yeah. The thing is, like in political commentary, no one's ever wrong. Why would they ever admit that they're wrong? Their fans will hate that they will admit that they're wrong. They'll defend them if they just continue being wrong. Mm-hmm. It's one of the most frustrating things about this. So I have been very frustrated by the fact that the apparent insider trading that multiple senators engaged in earlier this year after finding out behind the scenes information about how likely coronavirus could be really bad in America, that became a big story for like a day and then everyone moved on. I'm hoping that will change, especially as new information from reporters is coming out about this. Now, this involves Jeffrey Sprecher, chairman of the New York Stock Exchange, and also husband of Senator Kelly Loeffler, one of those most wrapped up in this story. So let's talk about some of the exchanges in stock that her husband did. So earlier this year, he bought $206,000 in chemical giant DuPont de Nemours in four transactions in late February and early March. DuPont has performed poorly on Wall Street lately, but the company is a major supplier of desperately needed personal protective gear as a global pandemic strains hospital and first responders. So far, it doesn't look like that stock is doing amazingly, but it would be reasonable to expect that it would in the future, and certainly at that point, that seemed like a pretty safe bet. At the same time, the couple dumped over $70,000 in stock from Ross Stores and similarly almost $30,000 in stock from the parent company of TJ Maxx and Marshalls. They also sold nearly $60,000 in Lululemon stock in early March, just after the stock dipped from its all-time high. And I think it's safe to assume that retail stores are going to do badly when people can't go outside and can't shop and the stores are shut down for literally months. Again, none of this is proof that she personally said that these changes, that these sales and purchases need to happen. She's saying that she didn't, but it all does line up with someone who is getting information that this is going to be serious, wants to personally profit or at least minimize losses from that information, while publicly saying that everything's going to be fine. Donald Trump is doing a great job. There's no reason for you to worry about all this.
The setup is perfectly fine as far as. It sets them up for a plausible deniability to say that, hey, this is how it all works. We have financial advisors who read the way the market's going and they give us these suggestions and advise us to do certain things and we just do it. I'm not connected to any insider trading or information giving to me and then leading that to my financial portfolio. So you can do that and then we don't have proof because we don't have the paperwork right there. We don't have the email or conversations that potentially blows all this up. So you can continue to ride this wave. That's the reason why, in order to end all this speculation, maybe when you're an elected member of Congress, you're a senator, you're in any of these positions of power where you have this exclusive information that can help you and to make it look like you're using that information to benefit yourself personally, maybe you just shouldn't engage in that while you're serving the people, because that's the beginning of how this worked. You're serving the people. From the beginning of the country, this country's history, being an elected official was not a money-making scheme. It was not a way to get rich. Everyone doing it wasn't supposed to be rich. Yes, they were powerful and had land ownership and all that stuff. So it's kind of set us up for that. But the vision of that was supposed to be something for people who serve the people. It's a part-time thing. You go back and serve your district and your community. And then you come here and you represent them on a collective basis in DC, right? That's how it's supposed to work. Mm-hmm. So when do we start getting into stock buying and selling and inside information and all those trading things that are happening? Because we just got greedy and we allowed people, the most powerful, to do whatever they wanted. I know we can eliminate all that speculation. You won't have to hear about me saying that you're an inside trader, that you're a liar, that you're a criminal, if you just don't engage in that while you're elected. And if you want to engage in it, don't get elected.
Yeah. Simple. Yeah. And I guess because they've been allowed to do this for so long, people react to the idea of the change as something extreme. But like, if you want to have this great amount of power, and if we talk about it as service to the country, why would we assume that you wouldn't give up anything to do that? You give up all sorts of freedoms to serve in the armed forces.
Absolutely.
Senators are supposed to just get benefits? And they will make money in a million different ways after having served as senators. Can we possibly just restrain one of them, at least briefly? Like athletes can't regularly bet on the games that they're playing in, right? Like, what if cops could bet on like crime rates and particular types of crime? Anything you have a personal ability to exercise influence over, to control an outcome, why would we allow you to personally profit from that when that could obviously influence how you do? Like, the athletes theoretically could throw the game. That's the concern. We don't think a senator could throw a stock. We don't think that Kelly Loeffler, who's been in the Senate for a couple of months at this point, oh no, her connection, her reverence for America is too strong to ever do anything unethical. Who actually thinks that? They shouldn't have stocks. Yeah, and thankfully some people, AOC, is trying to stop them from having it. It should be required. And this is the story that could break through to people. But unfortunately, not enough people are focusing on it.
Who was our, I think it was a congressman from New York who went down with his son for insider trading. Oh, Michael something. Anyway, we'll look him up. But this was last year, even the year before maybe, that absolutely busted on insider trading. That there was no question about it. He was using his influence.
Was it the first representative that endorsed Trump? Didn't
may have been one of those. Yeah,
I think that might have been
congressman insider trading. Anyway, yeah. But again, there's it's not like it's unprecedented. My point is that it's not unprecedented. Whether or not it was Collins, maybe Michael, one of those. Whether or not it's not an unprecedented thing for them to actually be doing this. So if you want to avoid being like him, don't even get yourself in this situation in the first place.
Yeah. New York has announced that they will be looking into Amazon allegedly firing an employee for speaking up about the conditions in one of their distribution centers on Staten Island, a warehouse where theoretically they were not taking coronavirus seriously. People had gotten it, and they were just expecting people to go about their day, work, and possibly be exposed to it. So I want to give you all the details on this. Amazon said it fired Smalls. This is Chris Smalls, former employee of Amazon, for showing up to work after being in contact with a colleague who was diagnosed with COVID-19 and being asked to stay at home. Smalls denied this, saying that his manager told him to self-quarantine on Saturday and that he hasn't been inside the Staten Island facility since, only outside the building in the parking lot to protest on Monday, where he says he tried to stay 6 feet away from other people. Now, he says he recently organized a walkout of about 50 people at a fulfillment center in Staten Island to protest the company's decision to keep the facility open, despite allegations that several associates there had already been infected with the disease. Smalls and other employees demanded that Amazon shut down the facility for a minimum of 2 weeks, theoretically to stop if there was any germs on anything, potentially die, but also get it cleaned out and provide workers with better health protections from coronavirus. Let's go to JR now. He's saying it's because I spoke up about this that I was raising concerns. They're saying he was trying to expose people or something by going back in. I find that hard to believe. If he was being asked to stay home, he was probably very worried about his own health at that point. But I'm glad that New York City is going to be looking into this allegation.
Yeah, hopefully, you know, because it doesn't benefit them, especially with all the other strains that they have with everything that's going on, to look into something like this. But this is important because this could go across multiple levels of workers that are still on the front lines. You know, we're giving props to the medical professionals and folks that are continuing to go to work, you know, the delivery drivers, the grocery store people, the pharmacists, all the people that are still staying in those essential places for being on the front lines. And this is, I think, some aspects of it that we forget. You know, we're like, oh, thank you. The delivery driver is out here risking his life. There's people in the warehouses still. There's people still putting things together. And who knows the level of contamination and contagion that's happening there as well. I mean, from subways and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Those things are, I believe, still need to be sanitized.
Yeah. 100%. Now, de Blasio said the allegation is because he spoke up for the safety of his fellow workers, he was fired. I have ordered the city's Commission on Human Rights to investigate Amazon immediately to determine if this is true. If so, that would be a violation of our city human rights laws. We would act on it immediately. And I would say, like, we need these distribution centers to stay open. It's one of the places that are going to allow us to weather this if it turns out that we're going to have to be sheltering at home for literally months. But yeah, we are allowed to have very high expectations on Amazon for what they're going to do. In return, by the way, they're going to make more money than they've ever made before. Not only in terms of far more sales, but probably they're going to be helped by the government. But that means they have to have extremely liberal pay, benefits, sick leave, obviously. They need to be encouraging people to take it if they feel sick. They need to be doing testing all the time. They need to be pervasively cleaning these facilities. Right. They need to take all of these precautions and make it, and by the way, they are hiring a lot of people. They should be making these places that people want to work during this time. But those people need to be paid well. They need to be compensated for the risk to themselves that they're taking by simply being there. And they need to be assured that they are not risking their lives by working for Amazon during this time.
Even if you're going to do it selfishly, I always wonder this about businesses. If you're going to be selfish and only think about yourselves and the bottom line and getting something done, you need your employees there. You need them to do it. You need them to have play their part in the process of getting your product out. So if you don't care about their health and their safety and they end up sick, you're losing employees.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, sure, we'll hire another one. But then you go through that whole process and you just don't care about the health and safety of the people that are actually getting you to your bottom line.
Yeah.
I don't understand it. Even if you're selfish, part of being selfish is making sure the people that are helping you take as much money as possible are there.
Yeah. Yeah. And so look, for everyone, all the employees like Chris Smalls who are, you know, they're raising these concerns, that are letting people know what's going on in these facilities, we desperately need this. Today, Bernie Sanders is going to appear on The View, and so they put up a little promo of some of the things they'd be asking him about. Take a look at this.
Bernie Sanders, answer accusations that he's politicizing the pandemic to push his Medicare for All agenda, and that staying in the race could guarantee Trump another term? He's live on The View. Next.
Okay, so that he's politicizing coronavirus to push his Medicare for All agenda. And by staying in the race, he's guaranteeing Trump wins again. And then they put up a smiling face of Bernie Sanders, like he's ecstatic about these horrible, underhanded, deceitful things he's doing. And then they say, Bernie Sanders, next. Like, what, this is The View. Wait, this isn't Tucker Carlson. Look at the spin on that thing. You can barely see the screen because it's moving around so fast.
The slanted view. I don't know. I'm not sure if the viewers of this show would see it as a bit of a blatant biased promo, or once they do have the interview, if they're going to ask him questions fairly and they're just looking to hook people. I don't know. Actually, I do kind of know. That's their point of view. That's what they're going to go with. That's the whole idea. We saw when they had AOC on, the approach they had with her as well. So he's using this pandemic to push the nefarious Medicare for All. Hey, are we pushing the way that the predatory healthcare system and private healthcare industry we have now is utilizing this to benefit further? Are we talking about any of that? No, it's just going to go to, he's taking this opportunity for a problem that has been long standing in our country to do something about it because he's just a senator.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that what our people in Congress and our senators are supposed to do? Find something that's a problem and then address it by changing the way we do things and making sure that more people are protected. Instead, you're just supposed to, what are you supposed to do? We complain about how the Congress does nothing, which they generally do nothing. But when a congressman or senator decides to do something, it's seen as taking advantage of a bad situation to make it better.
It's such a weird spin. Like, they could just say, is the coronavirus evidence that Medicare for All could have saved many lives? Next up, Bernie Sanders. You could have said that.
Yep.
You could say, is the fact that Joe Biden is effectively hiding from everyone, is that proof that Bernie Sanders was right to stay in the race? Bernie Sanders, after this. Like, you could do that. And by the way, think about if Joe Biden was to be on The View. Do you think that they would have done one like that? Would they have said, is Joe Biden hiding because he can't keep it together for a 5-minute media appearance? And what the hell is going on with the Tara Reid accusation? Like, do you really think that they would that they would come at him like oppositional like that?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. Will Joe Biden's status quo plan on healthcare continue us down this same disastrous path that we're seeing with the coronavirus?
Yeah.
That's his stance, is status quo healthcare system.
Or how about this? Failing us. How about is Joe Biden's refusal to contrast himself with Trump on coronavirus guaranteeing a second Trump term? You could do that. The View. They have millions of viewers. They're so important and influential.
What was their tagline? The most influential political show of our time or something like that. There was something like they said they're the most influential political discussion show because the number of people that watch it.
They probably are.
Just, know, yeah, they are because the number of people that watch it that are just, you know, this block of voting that when they hear and assess what they have to say, they make the decisions based off of it.
Yeah. I am thrilled to invite onto the show for the first time a candidate running in Massachusetts 8th District, Dr. Robbie Goldstein. Welcome to the Damage Report.
Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you on. For those who might not be familiar with your candidacy, this is the first time that we're talking. Can you let our viewers know a little bit about your history, what brought you into this race?
Absolutely. So as you heard, I'm a physician. I'm a doctor at Mass General Hospital in Boston. I was trained in both internal medicine and infectious diseases. And now what I largely do actually is primary care. I'm a primary care doctor for many people who have been left out of the system for a long time. So that's folks living with HIV, people in the LGBTQ community, and people affected by substance use. And actually, a lot of the work I've done over the past 5 years in the hospital has been to build the transgender health program at Mass General Hospital, which is a comprehensive primary care and more place for people to come and get everything that they may need. And that's the work actually that drove so much of this campaign and this movement that we're trying to create in the 8th District. I was seeing patients and continue to see patients who would come in every single day and tell me that it's not getting insurance. It's not the insurance card in their pocket necessarily that was challenging for them. It was all of the other stuff that was going on in their lives. Things like housing and education, things like transportation that were making it so hard for them to be healthy. And I thought, you know, I can do a lot one-on-one in this exam room, but what we really need is change at the federal level so that we can address some of these challenges.
Yeah, I'm curious. Actually, you brought up that you worked at you founded and directed the transgender health program. Generally, when I think about legislation involving that community, it's regressive state legislatures trying to strip away rights from the community. What would you like to see done federally? Would your experience running this organization, what would that bring to your time in Congress?
I think there's a tremendous amount that the federal government can do. You're right. We hear day after day what's happening in the state legislatures. We just heard 2 days ago what happened in Idaho with a ban on trans girls and women from participating in high school athletics. But there is a lot that can be done at the federal level. A lot of the protections that exist for the trans community, especially in the healthcare space, they're all based on interpretation of individual words. So for instance, when we think about healthcare, we think about the Affordable Care Act. The protections for trans folks really come down to just one or two words in one line of the Affordable Care Act. And I think that we need to strengthen those protections as we're going into a year when we are going to make decisions around healthcare. We recognize how important healthcare is. We've got to make sure the right people are at the table so the right words get put into that legislation so that we can protect every single person in this country.
You know, it's I can think of a few elected representatives who are doctors. It's not the most common way to get into politics, but there are a few. So I'm curious for you in the area of healthcare, which is obviously for reasons we'll expand on soon, a particularly salient issue right now. What would you like to see done in the future in regards to healthcare?
Yeah, so you're right. There are not many physicians that are currently in Congress. I think at my last count, there were 17, 15 of which were Republicans, only two on the Democratic side. When I think about healthcare providers being in government, it is because we have experienced what it's like for people to come into our clinics every single day and face challenges. And those of us who see those patients, we recognize that the only way to fix this, the only way for us to get out of this situation is to move towards a single payer healthcare system, a true system that will provide healthcare for every single person in this country and recognizes that healthcare is a human right and not a benefit for people who can pay for it. So my vision is to move us from where we are right now to a system of a single payer healthcare system where the government can be that person that helps to negotiate drug prices, helps to negotiate what is covered, helps to make sure that everybody can have access to the care they need in the community that they live in.
No, I also wanted to talk to you about some of the opponents that you're currently facing in this race. The first, the current incumbent, Stephen Lynch, who's held onto the seat for a very long time, a bit complicated with redistricting, but effectively has been the incumbent for quite some time, as well as Brianna Wu, who's a quite popular progressive figure. So tell me a little bit about differentiating yourself from both the incumbent and some of the primary challenges that you're facing. What do you believe that you bring uniquely to this race?
I think I'll take the incumbent first. Stephen Lynch, as you said, has been in office for 19 years, and we could have probably spent all of the time that we've had together talking about his votes and talking about my differences with him. I'll bring up three because I think they're really important. One is that he based his entire political career on an anti-LGBTQ agenda, going against marriage equality in the Massachusetts state legislature. Another is that he's repeatedly described himself as a pro-life Democrat and has voted against reproductive rights. Mm-hmm. And I think the third and the most important for me and the biggest distinction between us in many ways is that he was one of 35 Democrats in 2010 who voted against the Affordable Care Act. And he's one of only two remaining, him and Dan Lipinski, who are still in the House after all this time. And so I think, you know, he has showed us vote after vote his values and how he's going to represent those values in Washington. But actually, the biggest distinction between the two of us may not be those votes. It may be the way that we lead. It's really that idea of leading with values, leading with the voices of people from a community, bringing all of those people forward, lifting everyone up together, something that I've done every single day in the hospital and how I built the transgender health program, but something he hasn't been able to do in Washington.
Okay.
You know, to comment on Brianna Wu, I think you're right. There are multiple opponents in this race, and I think we all bring something unique and something different. I think my perspective as a healthcare provider, having worked in healthcare for all of this time, really does give me a unique platform to talk about the number one issue for people in the 8th District of Massachusetts, but really all across the country.
Okay, and let's talk about how one of the big issues is affecting things. I've been trying to get an idea from the candidates I've been talking to recently that you've been in this race for some time. I'm assuming the last month has been a very different sort of campaigning for you. You know, much of the normal sort of canvassing and things like that, rallies, those sorts of things can't actually happen. So how are you adapting in the new normal?
It has been quite a change from where we were in January and February to where we are now. Although I will say that if you talk to my campaign staff, in January, I was talking about COVID-19. It was at that time, we thought of it as the novel coronavirus. That was the term that was being used. And we've been planning for this ever since. So we made a pretty seamless transition from that traditional door knocking, canvassing, getting out to community events, trying to meet as many voters face-to-face, to doing that virtually and hosting virtual meet and greets, making phone calls and having group chats so that I can get to meet as many people as possible. But there are a lot of challenges to transitioning from an in-person campaign to a virtual campaign. And we are dealing with those in Massachusetts. One of those is actually ballot access. To get on the ballot in Massachusetts, we need 2,000 signatures. Those have to be handwritten signatures on a piece of paper. That's pretty hard to do when you can't get within 6 feet of somebody. So we're trying to come up with unique ways that we can get through this period of time while kind of moving forward with meeting as many people as possible.
Yeah, I can only imagine how difficult that is. So you've said that you've been talking about the coronavirus for some time now. Some in positions of power seem to have discovered it like 10 days ago. What do you think so far? As someone with this background in medicine, what do you think about the overall response to coronavirus inside of the United States?
You know, I think like many people, I'm disappointed in the way that the federal government woke up to this so late. I think there were people in the federal government who were talking about the right things and trying to prepare us. And unfortunately, I think those in leadership positions weren't necessarily hearing the warning signs. This is something that we should have known about for many, many, many years, actually. The CDC, the NIH have been preparing for this, but have been underfunded by our federal government. You know, if you go back all the way back to the Affordable Care Act, which we just celebrated its 10-year anniversary, that act set aside money every single year to prepare us for a public health threat like COVID-19. And every year, Republicans were in charge of the House and the Senate, and every year that Donald Trump has been in office, they have cut funding to that specific fund by $8 billion.
Wow.
That $8 billion cut has now resulted in a $6 trillion investment that we need to do to bring our economy back online. And I think that was the right thing. We have to get our economy back. We have to fund tests and the research and everything we need right now. But in a few months, we're going to have to look back and recognize that $8 billion investment that we could have made would have been worth every single penny and would have prepared our country in a way that we just weren't prepared for this current pandemic.
You know, so you mentioned there that we have to get, you know, our economy back going. And, you know, Trump seems to, at least as of now, backed off of his Easter, you know, restarting the economy drive. I saw that your governor, Charlie Baker, just extended the state's lockdown until May 4th. Like, how much certainty do you have that by May 4th, your state or the rest of the country will be ready to go back to normal or whatever normal is at that point?
I think May 4th is an optimistic date. I think we're all hoping that social distancing was put in place early enough, certainly in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts and all across the country, that we can see the peak of this pandemic in late April and see things get better by early May. But I think the reality is we have to be prepared that this can go on much, much longer than May 4th. You know, we've got to put some dates on the books so that we have things to work towards. But from the infectious disease side of this, from the public health side of this, I do think we need to be prepared for months of being distant from each other to make sure that the virus doesn't come back in a second wave, to make sure that we truly get control over what's going on in some of the hardest hit places all across this country.
You know, I'm curious, I probably should have asked this earlier, but are you still practicing as a doctor while campaigning?
I am, yes. Yeah. So I continue to do both jobs. We actually had intended that I would start to phase myself out of the hospital around now so that I can campaign full time. But obviously, when the largest infectious disease threat hits our country, as an infectious disease doctor, I felt called to service and have continued to work in the hospital. That's been challenging. But it's also really affirmed for me why I'm in this race, why we have the values that we have in this campaign, and why we're fighting for every single person to make sure that they can have access to healthcare, that they can have access to housing, that they can have access to a living wage and paid sick time.
You know, you're one of the first either doctors or nurses, any kind of medical professional that I've talked to in some time. And this is obviously a very exciting time. Tell me about continuing to practice. Are you worried about potentially being exposed? How do you feel about the amount of personal protective equipment that you have access to? Like, the nation seems to be really focusing on the needs of medical professionals. There's a lot of goodwill going towards anyone working in that field. From regular people, from the government, at least as an outsider, it seems like the priority is, it's not necessarily being prioritized to the level that it seems it needs.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'm really lucky. I work in a hospital system. Mass General Hospital has a tremendous amount of resources, and we've been able to make sure that we have the personal protective equipment we need, that everyone who walks into the hospital gets a mask. Whenever someone is in a high-risk setting, they can make sure they have all of the equipment that they need. But that doesn't make it any less scary to be a healthcare provider right now. And I think we need to recognize that people who are in healthcare, from the physicians to the nurses to the aides that are coming in and the people who are cleaning the hospital and serving the food, we're all making a choice to go out there and do everything we can to support this country and support the people that are coming into the hospital. And we're making that choice because it takes a little bit of courage and some bravery and to swallow down that fear a little bit to get into the hospital. You know, I have a lot of conversations with my husband who is very nervous about me going into the hospital and seeing patients, what that means for me, what that means for him. And we get through this together every single night, just acknowledging our fears and saying, this is the right thing to do. This is why I'm a doctor. And this is really why I'm running for Congress.
And because you have this experience, I'm curious what you feel like could be done to assuage some of those fears, to you know, make the next couple of months possibly as easy as they can be, you know, given the circumstances. If you were in power right now, like we've seen the recovery bills that they've passed, what should the next steps be? What would you like to see as someone coming from the medical field?
I think there's a lot that I'd like to see in what we'd call phase four, the next step of the stimulus package. And that includes additional money for ventilators and for testing, more help for people who are going to be affected by social distancing so that we can really continue to encourage social distancing. But one of the things that I think we have to recognize in phase four is that hospitals all across this country are being put in really challenging positions right now. They are shutting down their outpatient practices, they are stopping elective procedures, and they are losing a tremendous amount of money. And they are making decisions about furloughing physicians and nurses and other staff in the hospital, cutting pay to the people who are running into the fire right now. We need a federal stimulus package that supports our hospitals and supports our healthcare workers. It is not acceptable for the people who are really on the front line of this pandemic to risk losing their pay, losing their benefits, losing their own healthcare just because they're in a hospital system that can't be funded appropriately right now.
And where can people go to find out more about your platform, more about your candidacy?
People should check us out at robbieforchange.com or find us on social media at robbieforchange.
Okay. Dr. Robbie Goldstein, we really appreciate you joining us today. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.